try to remember that for future use. Okay, we're continuing our discussion on forgiveness. We discussed the obligations of the offender of having to ask for forgiveness, and we're in the middle of the obligations of the victim, who we said should not withhold forgiveness, and if he does, he is considered the sinner. And we say that if you can forgive quickly, it is more praiseworthy by the rabbi. So I believe we're at point four. That's where we ended off last time. So how far does the forgiveness go? How do you know you've forgiven the person? Like, there's two things over here. You can't just say it and not mean it. If you say, I forgive you, but you really don't, then you have to be honest with yourself. If you haven't forgiven them, just because you say you forgive them does not mean you have forgiven them. You following me? Just like the person who asks for forgiveness but doesn't mean it hasn't asked for forgiveness, as we'll see shortly, just as the asking of forgiveness has to be sincere, and that sincerity means that, you know, and it means I'm not going to do it again. I'm really ashamed of what I did, and it's never going to happen again. Then the one who forgives has to honestly forgive. Now, it's a little bit harder. How do you know? You can tell if a person's honest in asking for forgiveness if he doesn't do it again. It's kind of a good, that's what you can always know if the guy didn't mean it, because if he does the next day, then you know he wasn't sincere. But how is the one that forgives, how do you know that they're sincere? Maybe you're not sincere. So here's the way you can tell. The forgiveness should be the extent that you would now be willing to pray on behalf of the offender if required. In other words, you have wiped out the entire matter from your heart. And we find that by Avram Avinu. When Avimelech took Sarah away from Avram, and then Hashem punished Avimelech, that their all their orifices became closed. So after Hashem told Avimelech, you know, you did a terrible thing, go apologize to Avram, and you'll see he will pray for you. And Avram prayed for him to be healed. Okay, so that's how you can really tell that you, I mean, that's the clearest way of seeing that. There's obviously other ways you could see, but you have to act as if the matter is gone out of the system. Clearly, if you're going to take revenge on the person, even if you say you forgive them, then clearly that shows you haven't forgiven them. But it's got to be to an extent where you could see in your behavior, your attitude towards that person is as if you wiped the entire matter out. And usually praying on behalf of that person would be a good indication of that. Okay, however, let us not blur the areas where distinctions can and should be made. If a person, let's say, owes you, did an injustice to you, and as a result of that, you've lost money. Now there's two things that are involved over here. There is the financial retribution, and there's also asking for forgiveness. So now, look in 5. If outstanding financial debts remain between the victor and the offender, and let's say the offender doesn't have the money right now to pay the person back. So you might say, well, you know, I'll forgive you once you pay me back all the money. The guy says, but I don't got all the money to pay you back right now. Well, then I'm not forgiving you until you've paid it all back. Not a good idea. So but what are you going to do? So if outstanding financial debts remain between the victim and the offender, you can mention that the forgiveness of the crime has no implication that we are forgiving the debt he still owes you. You may encourage him to pay the debt back as soon as possible. In other words, what is being said is you should forgive the person for what they did. Let's say in an unscrupulous fashion, they've caused you to lose money for whatever way that happened. You could say, well, if you sincerely regret doing what you did, and I feel that you're sincere, you're conciliating me, okay, I will forgive you. I'll make it as if it didn't happen. But in terms of the finances, there's no reason why I have to forgive you to not pay me back. And you could say the fact that I forgive you does not mean I'm forgiving the debt. And we don't press them like really forcefully if possible. And we said, but I would like the money back. And you can always remind the person. You can even take them to Din Torah if you want to get your money back. But let's not confuse the two issues here. There's an issue of financial retribution, and there's another issue of wiping out the matter from your heart. Now you can say, well, how can I wipe the matter out from my heart if I'm reminding him to pay me back the money? Again, there's like two parts to this. The person owes you money. You don't have to really remember all the sordid details of why he owes you the money, that he cheated you out of this and that. It's no different than if somebody borrowed money from you and have to pay you back. So therefore, you can say, I'll consider as if the sordid details and the pain and the hurt, I forgot about all that, but you still owe me $5,000, and I expect you to pay me back the $5,000 in whatever way halacha permits you to collect that kind of money. Okay, now there are certain cases where you're not obliged to forgive the person. Okay, one is not obliged to forgive in a case where someone has spread false reports to sully our reputation. Somebody spread lies about you that are totally not true, and that's hurting you. So because this is something that's almost impossible to fix, the damage is permanently done, you're not obliged to forgive the person, you know, because it can't get fixed. However, let's say it is. If the offender successfully publicly declares his repudiation, only then would the victim be obliged to forgive him. So let's say the person publicly said a lie about you, whatever, said that you are an illegitimate child. That would be a kind of nasty thing to say. That would probably hurt in shidduchim and things like that, right? And they spread that rumor. It's a lie. You don't have to forgive them. You'd have to say, if you publicly, take back what you said and said, it was a malicious lie because I was upset at that person, and you now have told it to every single person, okay, then you'd be obliged to forgive them. But anything short of that, you're not obliged. But of course, although we don't have to, again, midas chasidus, if you want to be a pious person, you would forgive them nevertheless. Okay. And again, point seven is obvious. There's no obligation to forgive the offender until he has done teshuvah for his act and has come to appease us and ask for our forgiveness. If the person isn't asking for forgiveness, we're not obliged to forgive him. That goes without saying. More so, certainly if he persists in his aggressive behavior, would not be expected to forgive him. He doesn't plan on changing. Nor must we forgive him in a case where the offender has an attitude of, I will offend him and he will forgive me. Certain people have this, and I'll say what I want, and then later I'll apologize. No, that's the same thing. Hashem doesn't like that either. First, I'm going to do an Aveira, and then I'll do Tshuva on Yom Kippur. The Torah says, and the rabbis say, you won't have the ability to do Tshuva properly because you really don't mean it. Same thing, you're not obliged in all these cases to forgive the person. Now, there's one other type of area where you can withhold forgiveness, where it's for the benefit of the person who has hurt you. So one is justified in withholding forgiveness when it is for the benefit of the asker of the forgiveness, so that he'll not make a habit of his misbehavior, or for the benefit of the one who is being asked to forgive, if he thinks that he may suffer damage if he forgives the offender quickly or easily. In other words, there are certain people, they think, well, they could hurt people's feelings, and then they always go around and apologize, and they don't really learn the lesson so much. So, you could, if you really figure that this person, it would be better for you not to forgive them for a certain amount of time. So they realize, it wasn't such a simple thing. Boy, I really hurt this person's feeling. Even though you're prepared to forgive them, you really are prepared for this. Sometimes the question is just not ready to forgive them. Yeah, you're ready to forgive them, but you're saying, if I forgive this person and they get out so easily, I could see this is the kind of person, and he doesn't take his behavior that seriously because he always figures there's a way out. So you know what? For his own good, I will not forgive him. Okay? Then you can delay it. Because you know what, this guy he got off so easily, he's going to go and hurt somebody else again. He hasn't really done the real kind of tshuva that will make a real change in that person. Okay? So then you can say, you know, I don't really think you're sincere right now. He says, what do you mean? I could see you're smiling and laughing and giggling while I'm in pain, and you're saying, ah, of course, you forgive me, right? So I say, you know what, I don't really sense any sincerity in what you're doing, and I refuse to forgive you, and you should carry the burden of your sin. You know, that depends how you're going to say it. Again, a lot of people, they don't think that that's a big deal, insulting people. It's just a joke, you know. There's people like that, or whatever the situation is, you know, financially or whatever. People don't, okay, I have to apologize. Okay, if you feel you have to apologize and you don't realize that you really should be apologizing and you're not really remorseful, but you're just going through the motions, I can say, I'm not going to forgive you. I said, what do you mean you're not going to forgive you? You can forgive me. So because you don't, you know, I don't think you're sincere. So then the person has to think about it. And then the person might think a week or two, you know, maybe I really did something bad. And the person will then come with a genuine apology. And you have to always be careful if that's your real reason or you're just trying to get back at the person. So you have to be careful when you, it could be, it's a very good thing to withhold the forgiveness because the person is not going to learn from this event. The person is going to hurt other people or yourself. And you got to make them have pause for thought to say, really, it must be really bad if this person is not willing to forgive me. Right? So there's all kinds of famous stories about that. The famous story is with the Briskarov. I'm trying to remember the details. It's always hard to remember every detail of a story. It was a cold, wintry night somewhere in Europe like 150 years ago. And the Briskarov is in a wagon with his coach driver, and it's a terrible blizzard, and there's nowhere to go, and they need to find a place for the night. And they finally see this inn that there's a little light on, and this. So they go over there, and the wagon driver goes and knocks on the door, and no one's answering. He's knocking, and finally someone answers and says, "Who's there?" So it says, "Me and the person I'm driving. We need a place to stay for the night." He says, "It's 2 o'clock in the night. You suspect I'm going to do anything for you? But we're freezing. We're dying." He says, "Okay, here, come on in, but I don't have anything ready here. You sleep right in the mud room over there." Okay, so sleeping in the mud room. So and the guy goes back to sleep. About an hour later, I don't remember which Hasidic Rebbe it is. I'm forgetting that detail of the story. A famous Hasidic Rebbe is coming with like 15, 20 Hasidim, you know, and they're going and they're looking for a place in, and they find this place. And they knock on the door, but this time the guy sees there's like 20 people. Like, this is good business. This isn't an old-looking, poor-looking man. It's 20 people, and that's worth it to get up in the middle of the night and make dinner and everything, and you're going to make parnassa. So he welcomes them in. He wakes up his wife, and they're taking care of the whole thing, and it's mamish. She's starting to cook and putting out schnapps and this and that, and they're making a whole tish for the rep and everything there. Fine. So then they say, okay, so now we're going to wash. So now to wash, they're passing by the mudroom. So as they pass by the mudroom, so the Briskarov, he's kind of, you know, doesn't want anybody to see him. He's like on the floor. And the Rebbe looks, goes, "Hey, the Briskarov! What are you doing on the floor over here like this? Here, get up. Come to the table." And he said, "Well, what happened? Why are you on the floor?" So I said, "Briskarov, I'm trying not to say anything, but the situation is kind of obvious." He says, "Well, yeah, I guess this is where they had place for me or whatever it is." So now the Briskarov, now the Rebbe's at the head of the table, the Briskarov's at the table, and now the host is like coming in with all the stuff he's got. And he's fed the food. And now the Rebbe turns to the door and he says, "Do you know who this man is over here?" He says, "No." He says, "The Briskarov." He says, "The Briskarov? Yeah, the Briskarov. Now go ask him for forgiveness that you made him sleep on the mudroom over there." He says, "Okay, I'm really sorry." He looked at Briskarov. "I don't forgive you."
Dervis says, "Vey, the Briskarov didn't forgive you. You must have really done something really bad. The Briskarov's a tzaddik. Why did he forgive you?" He says, okay. I'm really sorry about this. And the Briskarov says, "I don't forgive you." Okay, then the guy starts falling on the floor and he starts bawling his eyes out and says, "Oh, this is terrible, terrible. Please, I'm going to feel like I'm going to die if you don't forgive me." So Briskarov says, "Okay, I'll forgive you, but under one condition." He says, "What?" He says, "Okay, I got to tell you a Dvar Torah." So, that's how a rabbi does things. I'm going to tell you a Dvar Torah. And he says it's during the parsha of when Shechem raped Dinah, Yaakov's daughter. And when Yaakov found out about it, it says that Yaakov was very saddened about what happened. He said, For a nevala was done to the Jewish people, a disgraceful thing was done to the Jewish people, and so it should not be done. So he says, the question is, it already says it was a disgraceful thing that was done for Yaakov. Why does it have to say, and such a thing wasn't done? So he says, well, you know, Shechem, he could have said, you know, I didn't know who I raped was such an important woman. Had I known she was such an important woman, I wouldn't raped her. But Torah says, no, that's not good enough. Because you know what? And so it should not be done. You don't rape anybody. You don't rape anybody. So therefore, Shechem wasn't punished merely for raping Yaakov's daughter to say, well, I didn't know it was Yaakov's daughter. It was Yaakov's daughter. I wouldn't have raped her. Yeah, but you know, you're not supposed to rape anybody. And for that already, you're guilty. So he says, why are you really asking for my forgiveness? Because it's the Briskarov? What's it going to help? What happens when another poor fellow comes along? You're not going to want to forgive him. You're not going to treat him nicely. It's only because of the Briskarov you're sad, because you know what that carries, that the sin was so great. No, it's even to any poor person. It says, you got to promise me that no matter who the poor person is, you will be able to treat him nicely. And if you're doing it that way, and you promise me that no matter who it is, you'll forgive him, then I'll forgive you. And not only that, but whenever you come to Brisk, I want you to be my guest, and I'll show you how to take care of guests as well. Then the guy finally said he was sorry, and this and that worked out. So that's a classic example of withholding forgiveness because you want the person to gain in that process, like the Briskarov did. So that's when you can withhold that. Now, the last little point, it's a bit of a subtle point, is there are certain situations where although the victim has no rightful claim to monetary compensation, okay, in Jewish law, not like secular law, there's many times if you damage someone, you're not obliged to pay. And one of the classic ones is in the Gemara is called Grumma, where you're an indirect cause of someone to lose money. You know, it's not like you took an item of his and destroyed it. But, you know, under certain circumstances, if you were careless with it and the item just happened to get destroyed or, you know, it just, a lot of times the common person, you know, promised they'd do something for you and they didn't do it for you. And because they didn't do it for you, now, like, let's say you're counting on someone to get you a ride or do something, and you could have got a ride somewhere else, and they said, no, I'll take you, and now they didn't give you the ride, and now you have no one else give you the ride, now you got to take a taxi, and now you got to pay $100, and because the person did that, you ended up losing $100. And the person, you know, really, when they promised it, they really didn't think it through so well, they should never promise to do it for you, and now you ended up losing money because of them. Okay, so you got to pay back the money. So what did I do? I just didn't give you the money. Yeah, but I was counting on you, and you knew I would have to pay, and someone else was going to do it for free, and you were doing this. So because you all of a sudden, you go to Bezdin say the guy's putter, because he was only an indirect cause, right? So on the other hand, you could still say, and this is what it says, well, yeah, you know, the guy's putter, but you can have what we call in the Talmudic word a taromes, which means I can have a complaint against the guy. In other words, you know, you hurt me, and I can't get the money out of you legally, but you should know, in Yiddish, the word sounds better, I have tainus on you. It doesn't translate so well in English. I have complaints on you, and you're entitled to have the complaint on that person to at least extract from him some type of conciliation A lot of times you don't feel there's so much remorse. Like, well, so I couldn't give him the ride. Yeah, but did you ever think about what happened? Or, you know, how about when, you have carpools and like this time of year, right? Isn't it, you start thinking over the carpool situation for next year? Or maybe it's already too late. Maybe you probably done that in March, right? And, you had a carpool and you said, okay, you had five people in the carpool and you analyze, this person was always not the best person in the carpool and you're not, you don't really want to tell them. It's hard to tell them that you want to drop them out of the carpool and everyone waits and pushes it off. And instead of telling them in March that they're not in your carpool, you kind of, in July, when the person calls, says, so what's with the carpools? Oh, so-and-so is in the carpool, and it's not working out for you. See, what? You didn't tell me that? Well, we kind of made up that we won't want you in the carpool. Oh, now I'm not in a carpool. It's already July. I can't ask anybody. Now I got to ask a bus service, and I got to spend $3,000 and this and that. You take them to Besden, they're not going to have to pay because it was just an indirect cause. It was not an actual damage. It was an indirect cause. I mean, you never really said it wasn't a contract. It would be very hard in a Jewish court of law to extract any money. So you're going to say, so is that the end of it? Well, no, you're entitled to have taromes. That's what it's called. You're entitled to say, I have a complaint against you, and you should really try to make it up. Again, you can't extract it in a court, but you're entitled to have a complaint against them. So depending on how severe it is, you could say, listen, I'm holding this against you because you did create a big damage for me, even though you don't have to pay. And you're entitled to hold it out until the person either conciliates you and says, oh, really, really, sir, whatever. Or you could say, I'd like some kind of reparation. I'm not going to expect $3,000, but, you've really made a big problem for me. You're entitled to that. So, if it gets any further than that, then you should ask a Rav for the details of that. But, okay, if you're a real tzaddik, you'd say, okay, I guess this too is the will of Hashem, and we'll have to take it in stride and just forgive the person. But the halacha recognizes that you have extremely hurt feelings and things really haven't been fixed up. And you're entitled to have some type of taromes, some type of complaint against the person in such a situation. And until things get addressed, you do not have to forgive them. Okay, so those are the exceptions to the rules. Okay, any more questions on forgiveness? Pretty straightforward. So now we go to the next topic, which is out of the frying pan and into the fire. Machlokes! Avoiding strife and pursuing peace. So again, these all overlap, obviously, but they're independent averos. That's what I'm trying to press upon here. Don't figure, well, I just took revenge, that's all I'm involved with. No, there's another aspect of machlokes. So it's a little bit tricky to explain this because we have to define the terms. But clearly the Torah says it's a prohibition. The Torah says prohibits us from engaging in machlokes, which we're going to, from now on, call it machlokes. After we give it a short definition, we can simply say it's quarreling. We could use it as that, but we'll have to define that. It says clearly, he shall not be like Korach in his congregation. The story of Korach, where he rebelled against Moshe and had a machlokes against Moshe's leadership. And over there was respect for Moshe's leadership. So what did Korach do? He got a large number of people to question and quarrel over this, that Moshe is the leader. And now he created sides and created a humongous dispute. This is what a machlokas is. So who's Moshe to be the boss? Maybe someone else to be the boss, right? That was a real machlokas. That was the first machlokas the Jewish people had as a nation. And we know what happened at the end of the story, that he got swallowed up. But the Torah later on says you have to be careful not to make machlokes like Korach. So that's a separate lav. Besides anything else that will overlap, you cannot, and how far does this go? Anyone who supports, obviously you can't create a machlokes. If you support a machlokes, it violates the mitzvah, whether you instigate a fight between two people or further the conflict. Okay, so how are we going to define it? Okay, we could use all kinds of English words. But, you know, it still needs more than that. But it can still be defined as, which could include, you know, disagreement, dissension, dispute, argument, argumentativeness, divisiveness, strife, fighting, feud, conflict, contentiousness, insurgency, rebellion, and open warfare. I mean, there's levels of machlokes. You know, just think of Hatfields and McCoys. You know, it's like a family feud. This has been going on for generations. We don't like each other. Let's say in the olden days, Hasidim and Misnagdim. Those are against that. That was clearly machlokes, where people are just, you know, he's my enemy. We're fighting over this issue. We're obviously, and it's not a creative, what do you call it? There's two words. One is an idea of a collegial relationship. Those are the words. And one is an adversarial relationship. So you're going to ask, what do you mean? Can't you ever disagree with somebody? Of course you can disagree with somebody. You have to understand that some machlokas are okay. Some machlokas are not okay. We know that in Pirkei Avos. It says that if it's a machlokas, we'll get to it, but a machlokas, l'shem shemayim, a machlokas is for the sake of heaven, that's okay. Like Hillel and Shammai. But a machlokas that's not l'shem shemayim, which was Korach and his group, that is not l'shem shemayim. So I think the best way of defining it is your machlokas adversarial or is it collegial? So I probably have to define those terms. So collegial from the word colleague. Colleague means you're on the same side. You're on the same side, but you're having a difference as to what should happen. But we're on the same side. We're on the same team. We're just having a disagreement as to what should we do. But we look at ourselves as colleagues. We're in it together. We're on the same team. But on the same team, we're having a difference of how to deal with something. That's not, that's permitted. And it could even be laudable. But if it becomes an adversarial type of machlokas, where you say you're the other side, you're not on my side, and I'm against you and everything that you represent over here in this, that is what you're not allowed to have. Am I making that a little bit clear? Okay, so, and this, you know, can obviously happen on all levels. It can happen with strangers. It can happen, this surely happens in many boards of religious institutions or business institutions where machlokas can be rampant. That's why when people, you know, advise me, you know, should I, they ask me to be on the board of such and such, almost all the time I say, don't, because there's just too many averis that are going to be going on over there, unless it's a very unique type of situation. But it's just not good. But if it's causing where you're not really on this, and that can also, obviously, where's the most often where you're going to find machlokas? In your own home. A husband and wife can transgress this avera. Clearly, if depending on are they, sometimes a spouse looks at the other spouse as an adversary. And you'd hope at least, you know, they could be a colleague. So when you're deciding how to discipline a child, you know, If it's a difference of opinion, but it's a respectful difference, and we're both on the same side, we both want what's good for the kid, it's not a question of me winning or you winning, then that's okay. But if it's got to the point where when you're involved in the disagreement, you feel that it's your self-esteem rides on winning this argument, and it's got to be because it's my opinion, and you're going to personally feel hurt if your opinion is not carrying the day, you can usually tell by your blood pressure during the machlokas. That will usually, if you have body awareness, you can sense what we're talking about. Your body awareness, if you're calm, most likely that's if you're treating the other person as a colleague. But if you're getting upset and infuriated like that, huffy and puffy, then it's probably an adversarial, and that would be a machlokes that you couldn't initiate or you couldn't take sides on. Okay, that just act of machlokes, even if I don't swear at the person, even if I don't insult the person, but there we've created a division amongst ourselves where I'm saying that this person is not on my side. You understand? It's my side and your side. My side's right, your side's wrong, and I'm really upset at your other side. You know, now you know it can't be very long until many, many more averis will cascade into this. It's just not possible. But we don't have to wait for any other avera we've talked about to happen. The fact that you've created the sides, that alone is the avera. Okay? And again, you might, and these sims, you know, if you have a very quick-tempered personality, it could very quickly become a machlokas. Now, you could fix it up, but for the time that it's a machlokas, and you could tell it's a machlokas, if all of a sudden you know, you're so upset with it, you can't hear what the other person's saying, and you walk away, or all these things, you have now created a machlokas. And that could just happen even in your own home, you know, how are we going to discipline the child, what school are we going to send the child to? You know, if you're not on the same page, you create a big machlokas. Where are we going to go on vacation? If you're now looking at that person as your adversary, then you have transgressed that avera. Okay? And clearly, they tell us, machlokas is one of the most destructive forces that exist in social relationship. And we can also tell how bad it is by the punishment that the Torah gives for it. Well, the first machlokas was Korach and his group. Okay? So, what was the punishment? They got swallowed up. Who got swallowed up? Well, Korach got swallowed up. His wife got swallowed up. The people who were with Korach got swallowed up. And if you look carefully in the pasuk over there, it says when they all came out the next day for the big showdown, they came out with the little children. And the Talmud says, you see that even infants were swallowed up. So we say, generally, Hashem does not punish children for the deeds of the parents. He says, except for machlokas. In machlokas, nobody is spared. Even a little baby dies for machlokas. That's how terrible machlokas is. And there's too many stories that I know firsthand of where these things happen. It's like, really, firsthand experience where machlokas happened, and then, you know, it doesn't take long where terrible, terrible tragedies happen to the people, the primary people involved in the machlokas. And we see that from Korach, that the little nursing infants died. You know, there was, and you see this often, especially if the machlokas is with a rabbi. You know, and you know, people, whatever, people on the board or lay people, they're gonna get the rabbi out, you know, that kind of thing, or make his life miserable. You know, sooner or later, those people pay for it dearly, dearly. I know a story that happened like a long time ago, over 30 years ago, not over here, not anything, a whole story where there were three people who were involved of trying to get the rabbi out. Don't even try to guess. It's like far away in time and place and all these things. But there were three people who were instrumental in creating a machlokes to basically, it was an older rabbi and wanted to get the rabbi out. You know, the congregation was going down. The rabbi was already past his prime. And they wanted to get him out. And the rabbi, of course, didn't want to go out. And so anyway, so it was a board meeting and this and that. And they said, we're gonna do a, what's the word? An investigation into the rabbi and this and that. And we should keep the rabbi out of that. Anyway, so there were three people involved. It really was, and was one person more involved than the other ones? And there were two who really just didn't like the rabbi. And the third guy kind of got mixed into it. And so then there's a whole long meetings and this and that, and at least one fellow was smart enough. He said, you know, we're going to ask another rabbi if what we're doing is okay. The other two didn't care, but the third guy said, you know, maybe we should ask another rabbi. And they went to another rabbi, and the other rabbi said, stop what you're doing. This is the biggest machlokas possible. You go and you apologize to the rabbi, and you stop doing it. Anyway, so what eventually happened was, to those three people, two of them, their children suffered great physical pains that they had for the rest of their lives. And the third one suffered in another way as well. I don't want to give details, but one of them suffered a little less, and that was the one who said, maybe we should go to the rabbi and get his opinion. But it was like textbook of the whole community. It's those three, they mamish got it. So when you know there's a machlokas going on over here, you stay far away. All Hashem has no mercy for machlokas. As much as He's merciful for so many things, you could have an adulterous relationship. Hashem is more merciful on that than on machlokas. So you really want to stay away from that like fire. There's so many stories about this. Okay. So now, this mitzvah applies to men and women in all places and at all times. Children should be taught from a young age to steer clear of fights and should be guided to avoid associating with argumentative people who regularly feud with others. Certainly, parents should never involve their children in their own machlokes or command their children to support them against an enemy. You know, we don't go to the Schwartzes anymore. I don't want you playing with the Schwartz boy. Why? Because I'm a fighting with the Schwartzes, and I want everything to do. You can understand why a parent would do that from their emotionally skewed way of looking at things. But what are you getting the kid involved in it? The kid wants to play with the other kid. He's not part of the fight. But often these things escalate. We don't talk to them anymore. That's it. We don't invite them to our weddings anymore. I don't want you to play with his kids anymore. That's mamish osser. It's 100% usher to the extent, point nine, if a parent does tell the child that, the child should not obey the parents. You have to say, sorry, just because you're fighting with Mr. Schwartz, I'm still good friends with Moishi, and I'm going to continue to play with him. And no matter what your parents say, you're not to listen to them. Okay? And more so, the children should try to do everything they can to patch up the machlokas that the parents are involved in, if there's any way to do that. Okay, so that, yes?
That was a question. If you think you could resolve it, but there's a chance that you'd get involved, is it preferable to stay then out?
You gotta ask a shayla. You gotta know if you think you can do it without getting involved. The person has to think it over well. If you feel that you can say emotionally, objectively disconnected from the whole situation, if you think you can do that. I mean, obviously, you know, let's say someone like Aaron HaKohen was Ohe Shalom Varodev Shalom, he would go out of his way to bring peace between people, and he was not affected by it, because I guess he was Aaron. Now you want to say if you're someone's kid, I mean, you have, we know families where the uncles and aunts don't talk to each other. There are such families, and you're on the cousin level, right? So yeah, you could try to help it, as long as you treat it in a collegial fashion. If you can treat it in a collegial fashion, and if you feel it won't make things even worse, you have to be careful. But you definitely should try it. It's not good. It's not good that anyone in the Jewish people should have this type of reality. And it's a mitzvah to stop the machlokas. But you have to be skillful, like Aaron HaKohen was skillful. If you're skillful, you could do it too. Again, you have this is a major problem when couples get divorced. You don't think that's machlokas? You know, where the one spouse says to the kids, I don't want you going to your father. You know, and if you're making a wedding, don't invite your father. If you're inviting your father to the wedding, I'm not going to the wedding. Right? You don't think this happens? So what's the child supposed to do? Spouse will say, I'm not getting involved in your fight. I'm inviting you. I'm inviting your father. And you know what? It's your call what you want to do. And that's all. And it's really, and you could even say, respectfully, it's disgraceful that you're behaving this way. And I'm, you know, again, you have to know how to say it and say, I'm really ashamed that you're my mother to even suggest such a thing. You know, you have to say it the right way, this and that, but I'm just telling you. But it's your job to say you don't approve of this. Now, get it. Let's assume it was a kind of divorce where both parties are at fault. I'm not talking where one spouse really was just terrible and destroyed the other spouse. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about most divorces, there's fault on both sides, or or no fault on both sides, and but they get really ugly. So now that's clearly, so now you got, you know, you remember these ex-spouses have to, even though you get divorced, you cannot have machlokas. You cannot, and people would be well served to know that when you're negotiating terms of settlement of divorce, to not allow it to escalate into a machlokas. You know, obviously a woman is entitled for fair child support, okay? But if it becomes now, you know, just to spite the other person, and now you're looking at the ex-spouse as an enemy, you still can't do that. You can't look at them as an enemy. You can say, listen, I'm entitled to look out for my best interest, and you are, and let's try to take it to a bezdin without escalating it with lawyers. All this stuff goes on with lawyers here and all that. That's clearly, from a Torah perspective, usur. Clearly, I'm not talking about you hire a lawyer just because they know the legalities. But if you can't come to a reasonable conclusion, then clearly someone is transgressing machlokas. And even if you're getting divorced, does not exempt you from being in machlokas. Doesn't. Oh, he's terrible. It doesn't matter you think he's terrible. You're not allowed to maintain a machlokas. And if you know, if they would just go to a bezin will do it fairly. They're not going to pick one side or the other, and you'd save so much. But you know, so that clearly that just applies the same thing. So you know, Hashem should protect these kinds of people. So the children could say, you know, and then we'll have the children get involved, and it gets very ugly. So you got to say, no, we feel you're wrong, and if you persist in doing this, you know, the children have to be clever to know what leverage they carry to try to minimize the machlokas. Okay. Oh, 10. When two people have a disagreement, their goal should be to resolve their differences. That should be the goal. The goal is, we have differences, let's resolve them. Let's not keep them. You know, there are certain people who love to keep differences because that's what they live on. They live on saying, I don't like this guy because of this, and I don't like this guy. And they live on these differences. You got to say, listen, if you have a disagreement, let's resolve it and let's not make any differences anymore. Unfortunately, the method they most commonly use to achieve their goal is fighting it out, which is not the way it should be done. So now, how do you avoid having a difference turn into a machlokas? So as soon as two individuals see they are unable to reach an understanding and accommodate each other on their own, they should go to a third party, someone who is acceptable, both of them, to help them negotiate a compromise. I seem to always forget the E's. Okay. The third party might be a Rav, a mutual friend, or a fellow businessman. If the option is not available or if their efforts are unsuccessful, their next step should be to go to a Din Torah. And the Din Torah is meant to resolve the difference. You know, when you go to a Din Torah, the first question that the rabbis will ask the two litigants are, do you insist on doing this according to law, or are you agreeable to pshara, to compromise? And the Shulchan Aruch writes, it's a mitzvah for the Beis Din to try to get a compromise as opposed to have a winner or a loser. Now, although the fact is many cases there could be, if you finally get to the bottom line, there will be a winner and a loser. But the Bezin, in spite of that fact, they're encouraged to say, let's compromise. Why are you... I forgot the exact lashon. Joe Berman, Zichrono Livracha, who was a big, big businessman, and I had the schus to teach him and his wife Torah when they were older. He said, I hope I say it over correctly. He says, A poor settlement is better than a correct judgment. Which means if you have to judge winner and loser, even if you're correct, that's not as good as a compromise that's not so good. Because when you make a judgment, that means the two litigants are totally at odds with each other and nothing was helped. You know, the person has to pay the money, he's guilty. But the two can never have a relationship anymore of I was the guilty guy, you know? As opposed to with a compromise, then everybody feels they got a little something, even though they're all upset, they don't feel they got enough. But you feel you get a little something, there's hope that things can once again come back together again. So that's what a Bezin, always, I always tell people when there's in machlokas, you have to know who you're dealing with. or is the person willing to make a compromise? You have this with Baal Tshuva families. The children are frum, the parents aren't. The parents want the kids to eat in their house. They don't have a kosher home. You don't think that would breed a machlokas? And just because they're secular, it means you're allowed to have a machlokas with them? No. Even though they don't keep the Torah, and they don't understand that, you know, what's wrong with machlokas, but you still are not allowed to encourage a machlokas, and you have to do what you can to try to avoid a machlokas, if at all possible. So I always say, try to compromise. You know, reasonable compromise. Can't always... the other side may not be reasonable, okay, but at least you're doing what you're doing. Remember, it always takes two to have a fight, like you showed. If you didn't respond to that fellow, right, there was no machlokas, right? So you got to compromise is always the best thing, but if not, you go to a din Torah, and the bezin will try to make a compromise. Okay, fine. 13, the Torah warns us, do not follow the many to do evil. What does the Torah mean by that? That means that we are warned not to support or encourage sinners, nor to join with those who approve of their wrongdoings. Okay? So, let's just say people who are doing things wrong, you shouldn't be involved in what they're doing. So, I mean, that those could be really terrible things. It could be things that, you know, people don't think are so terrible. What could come to mind? I don't know. Let's say men going to kiddush clubs during davening. Let's just give an example of that. That's a very evil thing for a person to go to a kiddush club during davening. That's an evil thing. And you shouldn't follow the many to do evil. Most people in the world go to kiddush clubs. So I don't know. You can't join them. Because usually those things go, the negative things go beyond the kiddush club. Because they're probably not, you know, doing divrei Torah and things like that. They're probably... whatever. So, you know, you got to stay away. Or whatever. People that are involved in not nice behaviors or whatever, you have to not associate with them on any level. Or a blatantly wicked person. You know clearly is a wicked person. You don't associate with them. Not even if it's involving in let's say, trying to do a mitzvah. Let's say that person's involved in a mitzvah. But, you know, their mitzvah is going to get all messed up. You shouldn't do that. And because clearly, these are people who usually get into machlokas, and now if you're going to be friendly with them, you're going to get on their side with machlokas as well. So you have to stay away from these people as a protection. Okay. And more than that, we should show our disapproval of machlokas, and how bad, by withholding official honors from people who are involved in machlokas. Let's say the person, he says, you know, he's... whatever, he's creating a rift in the community, and this person is not willing to compromise. He wants to keep the machlokas. So I said, a gaba and shul should not give him an aliyah. It should not give people like that respect. Because you have to at least say, we don't approve of what you're doing. As soon as you fix things up, we're going to approve of what you are. But if not, you have to show that you disdain it greatly. Now again, not to the point where you get into the machlokas itself, but just say, until you guys, you know, can fix this up, you know, we just don't want to hear about it, and you're not allowed to have certain benefits that other people could have. Okay. Now, this is how far we're supposed to disdain machlokas under certain circumstances. We're even allowed to speak lashon hara about argumentative people who regularly feud with others. But that will have to hold off, because there's about 7 conditions have to be met for you to be able to ever say lashon hara about someone, if you feel it's effective to diffuse a fight. But you have to be careful that it won't get the opposite goal. So you always have to be careful. If you think you're stepping in to stop it will only intensify it, then better just stay away and let the people fight it out, and you just stay far away from that. Okay, we are 16. We're allowed to engage actively in machlokas when dealing with wicked people, I mean really wicked people. But even then, we should be careful not to employ brazen arrogance. In other words, you do it humbly to disagree, but not with arrogance. The goal should be to stop their wickedness and to prevent others from being drawn after them. However, we cannot go as far as to prosecute them, since there is a principle Hashem favors the one who is persecuted, even if the persecutor is a tzaddik and the victim is a rasha. In other words, don't make their lives miserable, because Hashem... no matter how bad a person is, he has rachmanis on a guy who's being persecuted. So you can be tough with the Russia. You could not give him honor. You do all kinds of things. But to persecute already, that would kind of draw the line. He's got to really, really be bad for that. Even if a highly esteemed person should forgo his honor, if this will help diffuse a machlokas. You know, even if you're a very hush of a person, you shouldn't hold beneath your dignity. Famous story with Rav Gamliel. Rav Gamliel, who there was a couple in his neighborhood that the wife was scholarly, the husband was an ignoramus. So what did the Rav? So Friday night, it seemed in the days of the Gemara, when you went to shul Friday night, instead of a choir on Friday night or whatever, the rabbi gave a long talk Friday nights. So the wife one day, the rabbi gave a longer talk, and so the husband wasn't interested. He stayed home, and the wife would come home later. So one time she came home very late, and he says, "What'd you come late?" "Well, the rabbi spoke very long." So the guy says, "You know what? I don't want you in my house again till you spit at that rabbi. Get out of the house till you spit at that rabbi." So she has to go out of the house. She says, you know, this is the old days, you know. It wouldn't happen nowadays. You know, the husbands, the guys could beat up their wives. I mean, it's like, so she's hanging around the shul room. The Malil says, what are you doing? Shul, why aren't you at home? My husband said that I can't come home until I spit in your eyes. I can't spit in your eyes. He says, "Don't worry." So he starts feigning the following thing. He says, "Oi, my eyes, they're killing me. Oi, my eyes are killing me. I need someone to spit in my eyes to get to something caught in my eye. I don't know what it is. Oh, Mr. Schwartz, do me a favor. Spit in my eyes once, please spit. No, you didn't get it out. Again, please." No, he told her to spit in his eyes 7 times. He says, "Oh, I think it got out now." So now you go back to your husband and tell him, "Not only did I listen to you, but I spat in the rabbi's eyes 7 times. So that's how a rabbi who goes beyond his honor, even though it's beneath his dignity to try to resolve the crisis, if all it takes is forgoing your honor and that will stop the machlokas, by all means, do it. Okay? More than that, more refined people even forfeit a mitzvah in order to avoid machlokas. You know, sometimes, you know, it needs your time. Let's say a rabbi. A rabbi's got a mitzvah to study Torah. A rabbi's got a lot of, he doesn't waste his time. But there's a machlokas going on. And him being involved in machlokas means he's going to have to cancel his regular learning or whatever. And he's the one who could stop the machlokas. So even if it means you will, or let's say another example. Let's say this happens in certain communities, not in our community at all, but let's say you have many mourners, and mourners get to lead the services. And they feel it's a big thing to get to lead the service. It brings an elevation to the soul for the parent. So what happens is often people will fight who should be the one to lead the service. And let's say the fellow's got a yahrzeit, the other guy's got a shloshim or whatever, and you know who's entitled to this and that, and sometimes it's not clear, sometimes maybe they're equally honored, or you had, there were stories where the person, he had, there was a story once, a person, he was a mourner, he insisted on davening all the time, no matter what, didn't care if someone else had a yahrzeit or this or that, and he, mamish, pushed people away. And so let's say, really, you're entitled to lead the services. It's your father's yahrzeit. You're entitled to lead the service. That guy's just a regular mourner. Regular mourner is supposed to forego it. But if that's regular mourner, he goes berserk. He starts yelling and screaming, "I wanted this and that." And it's calling a whole hapla. You try to calm him down. You try to explain to him, "Listen, I have a higher priority today than you do." But if this causes a major machlokes, then the better thing to do is to say, "Okay, you could have it. Your father's not getting an elevated soul. He'll get a bigger elevation because you stopped the machlokas." Okay, you have to know when and where, if the guy's being a bully, if the guy's being irrational. But I'm saying it's always better to give in because what about elevating my father's soul? You got to realize that who's not elevating? So the bully. The bully is creating terrible, terrible things for his father's soul by creating machlokes. He doesn't get it. So hopefully you get a rabbi involved in this and that, but sometimes it just doesn't work. Sometimes it's right on the spot. You never lose by avoiding a machlokes, and that will eventually make things better for the one that you're trying to help. And now the famous rule in 19, we're even permitted to bend the truth when necessary for the sake of peace. You're allowed to really lie, out and out lie, if this will cause peace. You know, whatever the situation is, at home or whatever, you know, the famous story, right, say when the spouse comes home and they bought something on sale that really was no returns, and it mamish, the person felt they saved so much money for the family, and the person unwisely asks their spouse, what do you think of my purchase? And let's say the person make the purchase has sometimes does things without thinking things through, while the other spouse looks at that purchase. Now, the honest opinion is that was about the dumbest thing you could have bought. And that would have been an objective, honest answer. But you know, when you say that's the dumbest thing you got to bought, the spouse will now be upset and there will definitely be a machlokes. There's like no question about it. So you're allowed to lie, well, or at least bend the truth. Right? So you don't say what it really is. It's really ugly. You know, how could anybody, how could you have thought to, like, where is your mind to buy such a thing? Like, that really will not work out. You may say, you know, I don't think it was a good purchase. It's also not going to be good. So what are you going to do? So either you say, it's beautiful, or I always say, you go, now that's a dress. Now that's a vacuum cleaner. You know? Then you didn't lie at all, but you certainly bent the truth by saying it's fine, and you live with it. You live with it for the sake. Hashem lies also for the truth, right? When Hashem told Avram that he's going to have a child in his old age, the angel said he's going to have a child, and Sarah laughed. And when Sarah laughed, Hashem said, you know, what are you laughing about? She says, I'm laughing because I'm too old and my husband's too old. I'm an old bag and he's an old bag. So Hashem says to Avram, I don't understand why your wife was laughing. She said she was too old. But Hashem did not tell the whole truth, because she said that the husband was too old also. Hashem bent the truth. He did not say the whole truth. Why? He wanted to keep the shalom bias between Avram and Sarah. You figure who needs to work on their shalom bias, Avram and Sarah? You never know. But Hashem bent the truth. If Hashem can lie for the truth, you don't have to be, remember the rule, you never have to be more religious than Hashem. Never be more firm than Hashem. Now, if Hashem lies to tell the truth, you can lie to tell the truth. And even if it costs you money, I didn't put this down, even if it costs you money, you know, for example, just like we know, whatever you spend for Shabbos, Hashem pays you back. So you have to know that quite often, let's say when a spouse buys something and spends significant amount of money, and it really is waste. It should not have been bought and is a waste of money. So quite often there are machlokas between a husband and wife. You know, why we're trying to make ends meet, and there you went and bought a fancy dress that you know, don't even look good in it, whatever. It says, you know, I want you to return it, this and that. So, you know, smart people say, you know, sometimes it's worth it, just like you spend money in honor of the Shabbos. So you have to spend money in honor to keep peace in your house. If a person would remember that rule, it's so important. You know, you're trying to make ends meet, and one spouse blows $300, like a stupid thing. You know, like some, they got caught up in the moment, and they just, you know, bought another exercise machine. You know, already have five in the house, and I bought a sixth one. And you know, they buy it, and they don't use it, right? And they say, wow, I got this thing, I'm going to really... And you're saying, I've seen this a million times. Go return it. What? Return it? And then it's going to be a machlokas. Just say, you know what? You like it? Keep it. I'm happy that you like it. Even your mind say she just wasted $300. Just flushed it down the toilet. To yourself, you could say it. You say, this is the price to pay for shalom bias. It's worth it. And you kind of have to make even a shalom bias account. A smart person, a smart husband or wife, whoever's the one in charge of the funds. Just like you allocate X amount of money for a vacation and X amount of money. You say, this is how much money is going to be our shalom bias account. And I can go, let's say, whatever, I can go up to $2,000 a year. I can blow on shalom bias. That much I can waste on shalom bias. And then when, if you come knowing, and just like you know in tzedakah, you have to give 10%. You don't have a choice, right? So there's another, and for mitzvahs, you have to spend money on a lulav and an esrog and a sukkah. You got to spend money on it. So then to say, okay, we're going to spend money for shalom bais. And if a husband and wife want, either one, the one in charge just has their own secret cheshbon of the account, or they could say together, you know, let's make a shalom bais account. And if either of us really want to buy something, and the other one thinks it not, we'll say it goes in the shalom bais account, and we're not going to discuss it. You know, you have to be mature enough to do that, for both sides to do it. If that's not, then the one who's in charge of the money should be mature enough to do that without telling them it's the shalom bais account. You follow what's going on? That's how important shalom bais is. And finally, the last point will end over here. The Gemara says the entire world exists only in the merit who restrains his words at the time of a quarrel. When somebody says something, and you got a good rejoinder for that person, a really good rejoinder. But when you do that, that could escalate things, and you just keep your mouth shut. The world exists for people like that, and the rewards you get are immense for that. So we'll end it at this point. Next week we'll get into different types of machlokes that are permitted, some practical tips to avoid machlokes, and a few other important insights into that.